Welcome to the show, everybody. This is Alex Dolan. I am filling in for Pam Stack, who's out tonight. And I'm really excited because I get to interview Nancy Cole Silverman tonight. Nancy, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Thanks. Nice to be here tonight. Thanks, Alex.
I feel like this is kind of like a rematch or like a reunion because just a couple months ago, you interviewed me on this very network, and I had a great time, and so I'm happy to turn the focus on you tonight. Nancy Cole Silverman, again, is the author of a series of books that started with Beyond a Doubt, and that's book two, Beyond a Doubt, and they all focus around central character Carol Childs. And could you talk a little bit, let's kick it off, can you talk a little bit about the series and the character, Carol Childs?
I'd love to. Actually, I think it's kind of funny. You know, life will serve you things that sometimes you least expect. And after 25 years in radio, suddenly the station I was working for was sold and I found myself without a job. So in essence, I was kind of booted out and I thought, well, wait a minute, what am I going to do with myself? So after writing news and commercial copy and working what we call both sides of the desk, meaning I did everything from the time I was about 18 getting into radio until I was, you can add 25 years, I'll let you figure that out. I thought, I don't know anything else, so I'm going to write about it because it seems to me after working in talk radio, you saw it was like the Grand Central Station of any big market. You had all kinds of interesting people come in, and the drama that played out on the air was frequently much, much bigger behind the mic. And I thought this would be a good setting for an investigative reporter to start working kind of at the beginning of a career. And so I took a woman who was middle-aged, who, as many gals are, who've kind of maybe been divorced and deciding they needed to get back into the business that they wanted to be in. And she had, Carol, had a degree in journalism and decided that she had never really worked in it but went to her station management and said, give me a chance. And they said, okay, we'll give you a chance. And, you know, okay, you have a chance. And what's their biggest obstacle is about a 5-foot-tall, skinny little news director who looks at her and says she is the world's oldest cub reporter. And not real wild about having her work for him. So right off the bat, she has some challenges. And this made a very interesting scenario, and I had played around with it, and I've had a lot of fun with these two books. The first one, Shadow of Doubt, came out in December of 2014, and was well received. And the second one, Beyond a Doubt, came out in July. And my third one, Without a Doubt, I have a lot of doubt, is coming out in May.
And apologies for mixing up the titles before. So Shadow of Doubt, your first one in 2014. So that you've been very prolific in a short amount of time. When did you start the first book?
Gosh, I've always written. I've done a number of short stories and kind of radio plays in addition to commercial copy and so forth. So there's always been something there. Really, once I didn't have a radio station to go to anymore, I took over my son's bedroom. My son had graduated from college, and it was a large room. And I asked him, are you coming back? He says, no, and indeed he didn't. And so I went upstairs and just decided if I was going to go to an office and spend 8 to 12 hours a day, I would go upstairs and start writing. So I've always been writing, and if you Google me, you'll see I've got a number of other short stories and things out there. I tried a couple of other books, did the self-publishing route, fell flat on my face. I'm very, very thankful that I found a really fabulous publisher who seems to like me, and I like her too, so that's worked out well for us.
Well, I applaud you for not renting out your son's room and choosing the high road and turning it into a studio instead. Let's talk a little bit more about Carol Childs. So you have a young investigative journalist who's going in to an industry that you're very familiar with. Normally, I wouldn't ask this, but because I always try to embrace the idea that whatever characters are in fiction are fictional characters, but this so closely parallels your lifelong experience. How much of Carol Childs is based on you, and how much is a new fictitious character?
Well, that's a good question, Alex. I would say Carolyn is far gutsier and glibber than I am. But I took the experiences and kind of a compilation, if you will, of different people I had met and things I saw when I worked in studios and then just mixed them up and decided to have fun with it. She is not a real character, but she is on the page. But she really is not me. As I said, she's far gutsier than I am. And the fact, one of the things I wanted to do is that having worked in news all my life and around news stations and talk stations all my life was to share with people a little bit about how it is we get the news we deserve. And by that I mean, you know, particularly talk stations will kind of go after the stories they know those their listeners are going to want to hang on to. And I was really motivated when I wrote Beyond a Doubt to talk about things that happen in a city of 13 million people like we have here in L.A., like sex trafficking, which I have to tell you, when my publisher first got hold of the book, she goes, oh, my gosh, she says, we do cozies. How are we going to do with this? you know, one of the things in radio which worked really well for me is that, you know, we could never use those seven deadly words, dirty deadly words, as George Carlin like used to say, because, you know, if you did, the FCC would come right after you, and you'd have huge fines to make. So I could write very easily about very dark subjects and not have to get into using four-letter, very descriptive words. But I could, and because the as a reporter in a radio station, you don't see the pictures. And a matter of fact, even on a television station, you know, they will give you a little warning, a heads up, if you've got children in the room, if they're going to focus on anything, they will tell you, you know, such and such is coming on, or they'll blank the screen, or they'll fuzz it out so that you're not getting something. So you're talking about what happened. You're not in the moment of it happening. And I'm these books are written from Carol's point of view, so she is sharing what she's reporting on. So in that way, it was a good way to kind of sidestep yet cover a lot of issues that I felt were necessary for people to understand why we get the coverage we do. And in Beyond a Doubt, there are some young girls who go missing, and their stories are followed. Well, at the same time, there's some inner city black girls that go missing that nobody else in town is covering. And as a mother, that bothers Carol. And so she gets into the middle to find out what's going on. And because she becomes so close to finding out what's going on, the powers that be want to see her story cease and her cease. And so that it really becomes a struggle for her survival and solving this, which makes it kind of a page-turner.
So sex trafficking, missing persons, it sounds like that carries through beyond a doubt, the second book, and Without a Doubt, the third book. Are they themes throughout the series, or did you
each book could be a standalone. As a matter of fact, I wrote each book to be a standalone, and it's just like, you know, a day at a radio station. Every day is different. And it's the same type of thing that you'll say, well, why are we not hearing that story anymore? That story's gone away. It's because, you know, they've got their 15 minutes of fame and you're on to the next thing. And it really is based upon how much news you can get into any one newscast, how much detail you can get, and then boom, your audience level is depleted. You've got to go on to the next thing. You've got to compete with other stations that are going after the same story. You've got to make it more interesting. You've got to find a different angle. It's been covered, you go on to the next. So there's a lot of innuendos in the book that really deal with the policy and the running of a news station in addition to the story itself and the politics that she runs into trying to get something on the air.
Well, so I want to talk a little bit about your experience as a journalist because it plays so well into the development of Carol Childs. As a radio journalist, how long do you get to spend on a story?
Very little.
Is it less than a day?
Oh, definitely. You know, now, and as we'll see, and what I've tried to do with these books is we started out with Carol in book one, and she is very inexperienced in covering anything. You know, she spent most of the time on the marketing and sales side, and she suddenly, after, you know, 10-some years at the radio station, going to jump into news, and she hasn't covered anything newsworthy in many, many years. So she doesn't really know what she's doing. She's got to really sharpen her skills, and she's also not particularly well-wanted in the news department because her news director doesn't really want her and care for her. So she's got to prove herself. So she makes a lot of mistakes. Now, to answer your question, how much time does a journalist have? The news reporter on the radio gets maybe 10, 15, 20, 30 seconds will be good to cover a story. You don't really get to ask the follow-up questions you want. However, the unique thing about making her a reporter at a talk radio station is she will evolve, and she will move into where she becomes a personality on the air. And the advantage of having someone be a talk radio personality is when you listen to talk radio, and you'll find as you host a radio show, people think, oh, I know Alex. I like Alex. Alex reviewed such and such. Alex is my friend. Well, when you're in a major radio talk radio station in a big city, people are driving home and they're listening to you, and they either like you or they don't. And if they like you, they really have a one-on-one relationship with you. And they will call you, and they'll talk to you about what they feel, and they'll talk about politics, and they'll talk about, for instance, I was very involved in radio during the time of the O.J. Simpson case. We had people calling in and talking, and, you know, many times I think we had people calling in that were investigating the case that would just change their name, because don't forget, on talk radio, you don't know who's calling you. You have a name, but and maybe a number, or maybe not a number. And they will tell you things that they won't tell the cops. And so that
creates a... So your timing comes really well. We actually have our first caller. So if you're for fielding questions, I'll let this person on the air. Hi, you are on the air with Nancy Cole Silverman. Do you have a question? I think they hung up on us. Oh, well. and I will be, for people that may want to call in and ask Nancy questions, I will give the call-in number in just a bit. I just wanted to dig in a little bit further before we start getting started. But you were talking about, I know on air that you get 10 to 20 seconds per story, but in terms of being an investigative journalist who's, behind the scenes creating the story, do you get any, are you outside the studio at all, or is it all done within the studio?
You know, in the past, and really what I've done is I've kind of created a position here that does and does not exist anymore. In the past, you'd have somebody, and yes, you'd be in and out of the studio. And as a reporter, yes, you are in and out of the studio. The ability for stations today, because of time, to really do deep investigation is very difficult. However, a personality, which is not necessarily a reporter, may take more time, because a personality may have a whole show and they may have several hours, and they're going to have a lot of time to do a lot of investigating. And they have advantages because, as a personality, not everybody knows what they look like, and when I'm on the air, I'm going to use one voice, and when I'm out in public and I'm just chit-chatting with somebody over the cash register, I'm going to have another voice. So she could go into the public, and she could talk to people, and she could either use her name or not use her name to her advantage. And she could find things out that other people wouldn't know.
So if you were out in public together, you would not have this warm, very comforting voice that you use now. is your voice very different when you're not on the air?
If people, I think about, most radio people have wonderful round tones, and they speak very well, and yet you may see them. And I'll give you a perfect example. I was I was a general manager of a sports radio station, which kind of goes to show you God has a sense of humor, because I really was not a sports babe. But I had come from talk radio, and this new group was coming into town, and they needed a general manager, and I thought, well, that would be a challenge. I'll go take it. And I got hired, surprise, surprise. And I went in the studio one day to talk to my afternoon drive sportscaster, and I had not met him face-to-face. I was brand new. I was over at the station the first day, and I didn't know him. And I walked in the studio, and there, kind of poured in behind the console, was a 400-pound man. And in front of him was a huge yardstick pizza. And
you mean a pizza the diameter of a yardstick?
Yeah, easily. And he looked at me and he says, so you're the new lady. And I said, yes. sit down. You know, so now you're not going to know that this is, if you're listening, and this man was a tremendously good reporter. He had the inside scoop on a lot of breaking stories to deal with the sports world here in Los Angeles, and yet the average listener had no idea exactly what this man looked like. They probably thought they were very good friends with him, and they agreed with him, and they would call in, and they would talk fantasy football and sports and everything, but they didn't know what he looked like. And it was a lot of fun because, you know, he could go out in public and nobody knew who he was. And that was one of the...
Go ahead.
That was one of the basis for my ideas, is thinking how easy it would be for somebody who was an investigator to really walk among people and have them not know who she was. And also on the other side, to be on the receiving end of when you were talking about something that was going on in town. For instance, in Beyond a Doubt, when Carol is talking about the fact that these girls have been disappearing, and people would call in and to give her clues because they knew her, they liked her, and she could keep the story going that way.
Right. Let's talk about the plot of Beyond a Doubt, which is again the second book in the series. So this is ostensibly a missing persons case and and relates to human trafficking. Can you set up the story a little bit?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I've just finished book three and I'm already into book four. So I got to go back and I think, no, what did I write in that book?
Well, you know what? Let's dial back because, you know, for people there are a lot of people that are probably listening that are very familiar with your books. But for those who aren't, let's start with Shadow of Doubt, your first book. So Carol Childs is young, ambitious, very aggressive, confident, and she's really getting into this world of radio journalism. What and you mentioned the conflict she has with her producer, but what what is that then about?
You know, this book opens up on Shadow of Doubt, opens up, and everything deals, of course, here in Hollywood and LA because that's where I live and that's where I worked for so many years. It opens up on the scene of an Academy Awards-like show where there's a young ingenue that's up on stage and she has just gotten an award for Best Supporting Actress. And Carol is there with her aunt, Carol's next-door neighbor, who is a twin, is the daughter of a very well-known executive producer, talent agent, excuse me, in this town. And her friend says to her aunt, who's a talent agent, you know, this is really great, and she says, well, you know, she's got to leave early, and so he says, why don't you, will she stay after? And Carol really has gotten all of her inside knowledge about the industry through her good friend here. And the good friend has been feeding her information, and there's a reason why. And this is a real sense of, you know, how much do you believe from people? How much do you trust people? Are people using you? And so it opens up where the aunt goes home and is dead. And the next-door neighbor comes over and tells Carol, and, of course, Carol can't believe this, and she's concerned because this is her friend's aunt. And it really opens up with the mix of, well, how much do we believe her, and can we believe her? And Carol is new, and she's trying to come up the ranks, and this woman's been tremendously helpful to her, giving her the inside knowledge, which helps a lot in her news coverage of what's happening in Hollywood. And, wow, who is she? And what is this? What is the real connection here? And I think that's what, you know, as a writer, one of the things you want to do is to get into the mind of the reader and make them question things, make them wonder, is what you're hearing really true, or is there something more going on? And can you always trust a friend? And what happens when you have trusted a friend and you realize you've been used?
You know,
it's
funny. One of the things that we keep returning to, which is fascinating for me, is that the inherent nature of being in an audio medium like radio is that you don't, like you were saying, you're not really quite sure who the person is on the other side of the mic, and I like the fact that you're dealing with these questions of like how well do you really know somebody? How well do you know them versus based on your experience versus is that them or is that the persona they're putting out there? And I, you know, in your time as a journalist, Do you feel like that's changed? Because we're now like in this digital age where we all have personas that we're posting up on websites and social, and you know, you were saying the you know the sports guy with the yardstick pizza, no one really knew who he was, but today you might be able to Google tons of images and he might be posed with the pizza. So you know, like do you feel like that's that some of the mysteries peeled back, or do you feel like they're just more platforms to us project a false sense of who we are?
Well, I think people always present to you their best sense, their best self, and that, you know, you as a journalist, you want to think why, what's motivating that? Where's that coming from? And you know, I think that you're not, as a journalist, you're probably not too different than perhaps an investigative investigator is, or a cop is you're always looking for what's who's behind the screen there, what's going on, and those are the questions you have to ask, and those are the things that make for good writing too. You know, one of the things you learn to do in radio is to write for the ear, which was a, made it an easier transition for me when I sat down and started to write for the page. Is I had to create the sound, I had to create the emotion that you couldn't see on the screen. As a matter of fact, if you're writing for television, it's very different than if you're writing for radio, because if you're writing for television, there's the picture sometimes is in the way if you're coming from radio. Whereas if you're coming from
Interesting.
radio, there's no picture, so you have to create it. And when I sat down to write these books or any of my short stories, is I had the opportunity to create the picture. And it wasn't until I was into radio for, oh gosh, close to 20 years that I finally decided I didn't want to go out. I didn't want to leave radio. I mean, I really, when I came into radio, it was a love-hate relationship. I needed a job. I was a single mom with two kids, which again, like Carol Childs is, and I had to make it. There was no question about making it. But I wanted to make it in TV. I felt like I had gotten my degree in broadcast journalism, and I really had my eyes on TV. And my very, very first jobs were in the Arizona market on TV, and I wanted to do that. But I was in LA, and I had two kids, and I couldn't leave LA, and I didn't have what we call our numbers under you, meaning, you know, you have numbers on you, you have a Q rating. People are going to know a Q rating is a like rating, and nobody would have known me from Adam, but I could write copy. And I could write a commercial copy that could sell. So I got picked up by radio stations pretty quickly, and I was making very good money, which was kind of the gold handcuffs, and so I couldn't go back to television. And I really kind of cursed that for a while, because I thought, no, I should be on TV. I should go back to TV. But that's, you know, one of those things that, you know, you look at what life gives you, and sometimes the door that's closed is really there for a reason. It kept me in radio, where I learned to write. And I learned to write much, much better than I ever would have learned to write if I had stayed on in television. Although that said, once you go back into writing for the page, you better learn to spell right. Because in broadcast, you don't really have to spell, you just have to, or punctuate, you just have to hyphen everything. So I did have a few challenges going back to the print page.
Well, for the folks that are listening that are writers, let's talk a little bit more. What did you find the difference was between writing for TV versus writing for radio versus writing for the page?
Okay. Well, those are three separate classes entirely. You know, when you're on television, you have to consider everything is very quick. You know, the difference between writing for the page is, and particularly, and then writing for the internet is writing for the internet is space is not really as much of a problem as it is for the page, which, you know, you've got a newspaper and they can only afford so many pages, and that story's got to cut, and you really have the old-fashioned pyramid where it can be cut at the bottom, and you're writing the who, what, when, and where at the top and giving a linear description of what's happened. And words are important, but adverbs are not. You just give the facts, ma'am, only the facts. When you're going into television, you've got maybe 30 seconds, maybe a minute and a half on a story, but probably not even that. And you don't, that doesn't mean you've got, you know, that many words that you can get in there, because you've got a picture. And if you're talking too fast, people's eyes don't catch the picture. You've got to kind of work it both ways. You don't want to tell them what they're seeing. You've got to tell them what they're not seeing or what augments the picture. And when you're in radio, it is really a matter of creating that, because you realize somebody's driving, and you've got to give them that picture in their mind that they can see what's happening and feel what's happening. And you can use sound effects to your benefit. But, you know, you with each medium, you have different advantages and different challenges.
Makes sense. We'll take a quick break. I wanted to invite people to, this is a live broadcast. We're talking to Nancy Cole Silverman. My name's Alex Dolan. I'm filling in for Pam Stack. For people who might want to call in, we absolutely welcome your call. The call-in number is 347-633-9609. Again, 347-633-9609. I also wanted to mention this is a trademarked, copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. We are talking to Nancy Cole Silverman. So we talked about so let's go move on to the second book. So Beyond a Doubt, you're now into missing girls, basically, and human mm-hmm. trafficking. And so can you talk a little bit more about how that plot develops?
You know, I think I've always been very aware of the headlines and what's happening in a city like Los Angeles. And one of the things that, you know, you've got a big city and you've got a number of people that will go missing any day of the week. And it's not a crime to go missing. When I was doing some investigation on this, I was actually talking to one of the captains of the investigations of the missing persons team, and he says, you know, the thing is that people don't understand, that's not a crime. People go missing in a city like L.A. all the time. They voluntarily go missing sometimes to duck creditors or ex-spouses or just to get out, just to take a break. Usually people would resurface in a couple of days. And then there's also those that just disappear. And it struck me, particularly in the news, that, you know, if a pretty blonde girl was missing, it was all over the press for days, just days. But if a young black girl or Hispanic girl or somebody from, you know, the inner city went missing, nobody ever it never made the news. It never made the news, particularly on West Side radio stations with top ratings. And so I was very disturbed about this. And as I started to do some research into the story and realize where these girls were going, and you look at L.A.'s Children of the Night, you know, if they go missing and their bodies don't show up, or sometimes when their bodies do show up, you'll find that they've been taken in sex trafficking. And that was the other part of this that I think in this country we're becoming more aware of is this is not an overseas problem. This is something that goes on here in our own neighborhood, in our own country. And I wanted to kind of expose that and to how easy, how very simple it is for a young gal who is coming to L.A. kind of lured in sometimes by people who say, oh, gosh, you are exactly what we're looking for. You're the next Scarlett Johansson. You know, you come to L.A., we'll give you a ticket, we'll put you up, we'll get you your classes, we'll get you your headshots, you'll be meeting and greeting people, and you don't worry about anything. You're exactly what we need. And these girls would disappear. And so this was the kind of the beginning of how I could, see this plot unfolding. And wanted to follow it through in that regard. And then the people that would be behind it, because the people that would be behind it that were doing this were oftentimes people that would surprise you. You know, you see on the news all the time that people who were arrested who had been frequenting, prostitutes and so forth, and they want to black them out. They don't want their names and faces on the print, and yet sometimes there are people who have made this all very possible because they're people of means, they're businessmen, businesswomen, you know. It's so it was interesting because Carol gets into it and does expose this, and this is where it becomes very frightening for her and her family.
Interesting. So we're not necessarily talking about girls who are running away from bad homes and kind of turning to this. These are people that are moving to Los Angeles.
Well, they can be anything. You know, Yeah, when I was doing the research, I mean, one of the trades that really a lot of the gangs found was easiest to get into was sex trafficking. As you could kidnap a girl off the street, and she could be a pretty girl, and, you know, if she was right into town, maybe nobody would go looking for her. You know, maybe she didn't have a family, or maybe somebody thought she ran away with her boyfriend, or, you know, she was hiding out, or she got pregnant and just hid. Or another girl may come into the industry from another background altogether. She's lured LA, and she's a pretty girl because they knew she would be worth something. You know, they could make a lot of money on her. So it was an attempt to kind of, you know, expose a reader without putting the reader off. They're saying, you know, there's rattlesnakes out there, guys. This is not a pretty picture all the time. You know, everything that glitters is not gold. So it was a fun attempt at that. And yet, I have to say, that may sound very very serious, because the fact that I'm coming from radio, and because of the fact I'm coming on a timeline where everything is you're on a clock. It's a 24-hour live station, and you only have so much time. Well, Carol will be delving into this. She'd be taken off that, and you have to go back, and you've got to cover the news. And then you're working as on the top of the hour news reporter, where you do the news break, and you're working in the entertainment show. So you'd be going from something very serious, and we've all seen this, where a reporter is covering something, and then you have to turn to a lighter topic. And so Carol will be coming in from where she's investigated such and such, and all of a sudden she's got to come back, and she's got to talk about the fact it's National Crockpot Day. So it was a way to kind of keep, you know, just about the time you can just go, oh, it's getting dark, you can relieve it by going, but this is the way the industry is. This is what happens. This is how things move. And it would make it entertaining for the reader as well to say, well, no wonder you never find the ending of some stories or what happens. It's and the politics that go on behind the mic. So it made it a challenge, and yet a different way of looking at mysteries and writing a mystery.
It's interesting because you're talking about this in the context of a radio news broadcast as well, and so, you know, with any news broadcast, there's a certain amount of filtering that has to happen to make a news story palatable and not overwhelming for an audience. But with the book, like you were saying before, you can drop any four-letter word you want. It's a blank canvas. Do you find as a writer, when you're writing about something that has, you know, is a very sensitive subject matter, do you find that you need to put some sort of filter on for your readers because some of it might be a little bit too much for them, or do you kind of give the raw reality of what that crime is?
Well, as I said, you know, number one, because if I had written for radio, I couldn't use those seven deadly words, and I don't use them in my books. And because I was coming at this from a reporter, I'm giving you what I would have been reporting on the air. And I can tell you how I went about investigating it and getting my leads and how Carol would have gotten herself into trouble doing that. But you're never inside the young girl's head. You're inside Carol's head. So in that regard, you're able to understand what's going on, and you're able to say, my gosh, Carol is concerned because she's a mother and she's a reporter and she wants to see this story get out here. And at the same time, she's dealing with a management team that may say, you know, dial it back. We don't want that much on there. We've got to keep it light, you know. And so she's going back and forth. And so you're really seeing a story, but you're also seeing how a reporter struggles to get it and investigate it and risk her life in some cases to do it and to bring it to fruition.
So how did you research the subject matter?
You know, I read a lot of news stories, and I talked to the Missing Persons Bureau, and then having worked around talk radio stations as much as I did in newsrooms, you know, you would see these things happen. And so, you know, you'd see a reporter who is going out to, you know, cover a story, and they'd come back in, and maybe it was a tragic story or so forth, and then they're pulled off on something else, which is a celebration, you know, of, you know, Hollywood Boulevard Walk of Fame. You know, it's their anniversary. You got to get down there, and we have to make this a big deal, and you've got to be doing live cut-ins to the on-air show, and you've just covered something terrible, but you've got to then be able to, you know, pull on a different hat and talk about it in a different way and talk about a new subject in a different way that informs your listeners that the sun is coming out. And so
we have a caller. Hold on. Hi, you are on the air, Authors on the Air. Do you have a question for Nancy? We have a caller that's dropped off. But I'd like to, if you're out there and you want to call in, feel free to call back. We're at 347 347-633-9609. Again, 347-633-9609. So the Missing Persons Bureau, did they, what was it like to interview them?
You know, it was, I think I was very surprised because I didn't realize that, you know, it's a small department, and there's a lot of people who do go missing. And as I said, they keep coming back, and they came back and told me, you know, it's not a crime to go missing. Most of these cases, people will show up. A lot of times people wander off. You know, a lot of times they want to wander off, or there's a certain mental condition. And particularly, I was very impressed with, you know, how quickly they respond. If there's a child that's missing, they all get on it right away in all the departments. But there's a central bureau in the city that handles kind of, you know, the general missing population. So I found that to be very interesting. I have to laugh. I was thinking about how you lose calls, because we would lose calls on the air all the time. And one of the things that works so well in these books was that, you know, you'll get somebody who'll call in and they'll make something. You'll say, "Hi, and this is, and where are you calling from?" He goes, "Well, this is Sam, and I'm calling from Woodland Hills." And you'll start to talk to Sam, and Sam will say, "You know, I'm calling in because I want to talk about the trial that's going on, and I'm going to tell you, I think that guy did it, and I know the cops have planted evidence. And I'm, you know, and you're not giving the cops a chance to, you know, to talk about all this and something." Then they would hang up. And so, you know, then you're all of a sudden, and you know, you've got this caller in, and so that just directs the conversation off in that mood. So that's, I'm trying to kind of
There
give
was
an
there's
example of
one
how these things happen.
you reminded me, I went to a lecture with Al Franken at one point, and it was in, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, so it was in Berkeley, and Berkeley is notorious for very vocal, outspoken, pontificating liberals, of which I am one sometimes. But people would just talk for 2 minutes, and then finally, you know, Franken was just like, "Is there a question? Like, what is
And your
this?"
point?
All right. So then we have. So let's move on to book three, which is when. So when is the third book coming out? Without a Doubt.
Without a Doubt comes out in May, and this is, you know, I like to take Carol and kind of surprise my readers as much as she would be surprised by what comes forth within her day-to-day life of stories breaking. Because, you know, when you're a reporter working at a talk radio station, you don't know what's going to happen every day. It's not like you're going to a job where you say, "Okay, I know I've got to do a bank report," or "I've got to do, you know, I've got so-and-so coming in today." It's, you don't know what's going to break. So maybe you've got an earthquake, or maybe you've got a bank robbery. You just never know, but you have to be prepared. And so, you know, you keep your tennis shoes in the car, you keep your, you know, your jacket, your, you know, windbreaker, you know, your go bag, and you're out doing, you never know what. But the third book opens, and it opens in Beverly Hills. And one of the things that Carol is really been troubled by, and it's interesting, and I've tried to be really as realistic as I can, is obviously she's an attractive single woman, but she doesn't really have, she's had a relationship in book one and book two with a very attractive FBI agent, which is just verboten. Reporters can't have relationships with cops. And of course, as in book one, she's gotten into this relationship kind of before she started becoming a reporter, and she's thinking, "Well, this isn't going to be a problem. I'll just keep it separate. I mean, what am I going to cover? You know, that he's covering. He's a FBI guy. That's not going to be a problem." And he's, to be quite frank, too much of a hunk to let go of. So she's going to try to work it out. And so this is a challenge, and it's one of the reasons her young news director does not like her, is he doesn't think she takes it seriously enough. So by book three, we start to see how this does or doesn't work, and she has to evolve, and she does evolve, and it's a very interesting kind of way she evolves and is, and how she handles herself, and how she handles herself as a reporter and as a single woman, and as her growth in the industry.
You know, you're bringing up a point which always intrigues me when we're talking about series books, where you have this expectation of delivering a consistent character, which is what's compelling people to read the series, and yet there's a broad meta arc that's that you need to write to let that character evolve. And how do you balance that? Where at what point does Carol Childs evolve to the point where she's not the character that she started out as?
Well, I think the situations, you have to show how she changes as a result of the situations that come at her. You know, we all do. You can keep hanging on and banging your head against the wall, but eventually it doesn't feel good. So you kind of have to go the other way. And the situation she's faced with, really, you see her growth in them. You see the result of, this, you get hit in the face and you see, okay, whoa, can't do that again, and what she does. So, in book one, she's using her relationship kind of as a mentor in some ways, but he's kind of aside from the case and she can talk about it, but she's got to go out and do these digging on her own, and she falls on her face and does some very stupid things. And in book 10 and book two, she realizes she's got to really do this on her own. And so she can't include her friends from, her friends from the past and her relationship. She's got to keep a clear line, but that does cross over. And it's interesting how it works for her. And then she moves on to do different things. So, you have to have a little bit of romantic suspense in there. So I'm not going to reveal everything that happens. But, he's there. He's very handsome. He's a lot of fun. And they do have a lot of fun. But it's an interesting dance.
Do you get feedback from your readers?
Yeah, the most feedback you get are from critics. you read on Goodreads. And then Amazon. And you know what? I have one critic. He's a very tough critic, and I actually wrote him a letter because I thought, you learn really from the tough ones. If somebody is telling you, oh, it's great, I loved it, I couldn't put it down, and I really want everybody to read it, and what a great new character, that's great. I mean, we all want that. Particularly when you're new, you really want everybody to love it, and you want them to tell you they love it. But you learn when somebody says, well, I didn't think she'd do that. That didn't make sense. Or that was a stupid thing she did. And then the next time you're writing, you sit down and you'll say, you know what? I got to be more careful with that. I'm going to get caught on that again, and then I'll lose somebody on that. So I have found that, this is a journey as a writer. You learn from doing, and you have to do every day, and you get better at it. And I don't know that you ever get there. You just keep going.
You're getting at what I really wanted to get at is not so much the thumbs up or thumbs down kind of feedback that you get, but what you're talking about in terms of when your readers or when critics especially like or dislike something that your character has done. And I think to some degree that's actually kind of positive, because that actually means they're connecting with the character enough to want to follow them and not be happy if they take a certain turn. But so I guess my question is, what feedback have you gotten about people? Was there anything that she's done that people have really liked or really not liked? And if so, what was it?
Well, let me go back to what I was saying about the critic who really, I think I learned a lot from. He did finish the first book, and he only gave it 3 stars. And I think that was something that he even gave it 3 stars, because I think in a lot of books this guy does not even finish, much less review. But the fact that he did, and he says, I nearly threw it across the room because I don't know that I would have agreed with the end. On the other hand, this is a very subjective field. I had other people that really liked the way it ended, and I ended it that way very deliberately. I wanted you on the edge of your seat and not to know until the last sentence what happened. So, that could be subjective. On the other hand, I thought, well, okay, I can take that. And so I took that as a challenge for my next one, and then he liked that one even better. So it is a matter of learning. It is one thing to write pretty words on a page, and that doesn't tell a story. That is not a writer. There may be people who say, well, that's so literary, but it's a story, and it's got to move, and it's got to tell you something, and it's got to challenge you, and it's got to inform you, and you've got to keep it going. And that's a challenge, because you know, you may come in the next day and you kind of think, well, now we're, how am I going to get them out of that box? Or how, you know, or you get sluggish through the middle and you think, what am I going to do? I'm in the middle of this, book, and I can see the end. I know where I want to go, but it's who's going to finish it? And you have to be able to come back with ideas and challenge yourself that are going to make that reader want to pull all the way through. And I've you don't learn that until you've done it. You know, you're not a writer until you write. And you just have to keep doing it.
Yeah, let me ask. So who do you read? Like, who inspired you to actually put finger to keystroke?
Well, I've read a lot. You know, I've read a lot of different things. I mean, I can go back and I can tell you Leon Uris and Somerset Maugham and I'm drawing a blank right here. Michael Conley, most currently. I'm currently reading Stephen King, his new book, short stories that he's got out there, which I think is just wonderful because between the short stories, he's really written this book for writers. I mean, he maybe didn't intend to write it for writers, but really as a writer, you just glean on the information between the chapters because he really talks about process and he talks about how you'll look at something, and as a writer, you'll see something that triggers your imagination that somebody else just goes right over and they don't see it. But you build a whole story around it and how you just keep noodling at it and keep working at it until you kind of craft it. And, you know, the thing I have found about writing is it's rewriting. You can be very motivated by something and you really think you've got this, and particularly new writers, they'll think I've got the story done and they're ready to send it off to their publisher and it's the absolute best thing they've ever done. And it isn't until you've been through that book, you know, 10, 15, 20 times that you've really got it polished and you've really got it down. And it's with working with good editors who can kind of give you feedback because you're in the middle of the woods sometimes and you don't see the thing that the critic's going to come back later after that book is published and say, it wouldn't have happened. And if you've got a good editor who's working with you and you're working with a good team of writers, they can challenge you to go to that next step and you can craft that book in such a better way that it's going to be more successful. I think that really was apparent when we, this last year, when the book came out, I'm trying to think, I'm going to lose the train of thought here, with Scout and
The new Harper Lee, yeah.
Yeah, the new Harper Lee book is, I think that was a first draft that she had an editor who worked with her and said, you know, take that story and set it back in time. Make Scout younger, because originally Scout was going to be To Kill a Mockingbird. Originally Scout in the first book, The Watchmen, Scout was an adult woman. She says, make her a child where she's so enamored, you know, looking at her father and seeing this and explain it and make the situation totally different. And so by publishing the first book, you know, as a writer, you can see that was kind of a mistake, in my opinion, that was let out, because I think that wasn't the work she probably would have wanted out. As a writer, and I'm sure you do too, Alex, you've maybe got a number of manuscripts you think, okay, I learned on that one. I don't want that out. You know, I'm going to pull that back if it is. And
I kind of wonder if Harper Lee never intended for that to go out. And I suspect there's a low chance that Harper Lee's actually listening to this. But if she is, and I've misspoken, my apologies. But I get the impression that was never intended to be a public book.
I'm almost
afraid to read it because I don't know. I mean, I have a lot of respect for her, and I would love to hear what she had. I mean, I'd love to read it, but I also, it's almost like I almost feel like I'm looking at, you know, those leaked photos of celebrities that people post online. I almost feel like it's kind of something like that is something that's private that was never meant to be in the public domain, and I almost want to respect that. But I don't know. I also might not know what I'm talking about, and maybe she wanted this to be the next great bestseller, which it was last
year.
Well,
you and I are probably on the same page on that one, I think so. And, you know, if you do read it, I think, and I have not read The Watchmen, the whole title.
Is it Set of Watchmen?
The Set of Watchmen or something? I haven't watched it, haven't read that, but I think, you know, if you could look at it and say, if you look at it as a journey of a writer and how they edited it, you know, I think you could look at it as an educational thing, but to go back
for,
and say,
For those who are
so
inclined to correct
us,
it
think
is,
it could have killed her.
it is Go Set a Watchman.
Go Set a Watchman, yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that I think that every, I certainly hope I grow with every subsequent book. And frankly, I feel, I don't know how you feel, but I feel lucky enough that there is somebody out there that wants to read what I write, because I feel like stories are something that inherently make us human, and that stories exist because we have a desire to connect with other people, and we want to have them listen to those stories. And so I'm at the phase of my career where I'm just happy that there is an audience of people that is interested in the story that I put out there.
I like the term you use, connect, because I feel that too. I think one of the things I often found that when I was working in radio is that people will connect with a voice because it can strike an emotion. It can it hits home to the heart. You can be in a crowd of people and you feel very separate from them. Even though you're in a crowd, you feel very different. You feel very isolated. You can feel like, yes, I'm part of this crowd, but I'm an individual. But when you're listening to a voice in particular, or looking at art or listening to music, it can unite us. And that's something that I think as a writer we're challenged to do, is to find that way of uniting a mindset or a thought, getting under the skin and changing the way somebody looks at something and make them more aware. I don't think it's an accident.
Well, it also goes back to what you were saying before about being a radio personality and how you have this literal voice that's being projected out there, and how people feel like they come to know you and there's a certain amount of trust that gets built and they feel like they're connecting with you as a person. There's a point in my life where I was a musician for a while, and I feel like that when I was playing a show, people would feel, one of the good things about being a musician that was touring live, was that you would get to meet people very easily. And my theory was that other than the bartender, you might be the only person that's talked to them all night, even if it's from behind a microphone. And so there's the sense that there has been a connection made, even if it's been one-sided. But I think it's interesting that you're I wonder if, do you feel like that past experience of kind of being that voice on the radio that people trust has kind of woven its way into a narrative voice that you feel like can connect with readers?
Well, it's something I hope to do. I think it's very important. It's something I strive for. And I think it's a journey. I feel like I continue to kind of try to find the tone I want. I mean, because with the books, they are more soft-boiled. Even though the topics we've talked about, and I think as people might be listening, oh, boy, that's going to be a real hard-boiled book. That's going to be really – it's not. I mean, she's a very light kind of fun person. She kind of looks at things and finds a lot of humor in it, and there's a lot of humor in the people she's working with. And we can go in and out of some of these stories and these themes, which can be dark and can be very serious. They are what they are. There is the gallows humor that exists in this type of format and talk radio, and she is part of that. And so you do get a kick out of reading some of this, because you will go through this and say, oh my gosh, that can't really be happening, and the personalities that are pulling it off, like the guy in the corner office with the yardstick pizza. How often does that happen? You kind of go, oh boy, what am I going to do to win this one over?
Well, I think part of the function of humor is to diffuse tension anyway. So I think, you know, the idea of there being lighter moments, even though you're talking about some serious subject matter, I think that's totally fair. I think it totally belongs in that, because that's what happens in real life. People use humor to be able to relieve the pressure off something that might be too heavy, and you get balanced that way.
It really does. And as you write, you know, you think, okay, I can make you laugh. Can I make you cry? You know, and then you think, okay, that's the challenge as a good author. I think, can I weave in and out? Can I make you laugh on page 10 and cry on page 30?
Well, you know, is there an emotion that you look for when you're reading? Like, are you looking for a writer to push you in a way that, are you looking to weep? Are you looking to to laugh? Are you looking to?
No, but I'm looking to feel. I'm
scared.
Looking to
You're
feel.
Looking to feel
I
something.
I finished Jojo Moyer's book, You Before Me, or Me Before You. I've forgotten the title. Right before Christmas, and I was weeping at that when I ended, and I thought, oh boy, she knew it. She did it. She just pulled out the heartstrings there. Other books, you know, you can read and you can laugh and you can put them down, but I think it's those that make you weep. Maybe you remember those more.
That makes sense. So you have a fourth book that's going to be coming out as well. So the third one, without a doubt, is coming out in May. Do you have a timeline for book number four, or is that
I'm
still...
waiting for my publisher to tell me.
Yeah, okay. No, that makes sense.
So we'll see where that goes.
Go ahead.
I'm having fun with it. I'm enjoying it. It's going to come out, I can tell you that. Because I think, you know, you find your niche with that, and particularly with the series where she, you know, each story leads her in a different, each news item, breaking news item that she's working with is going to lead her to greater growth and developments and different angles and different things my readers may have never thought about. Because there's so many things, as I say, the stories that happen behind the mic were as unbelievable as those that were breaking out in the field.
That makes sense. We're kind of running out of time, and to respect your time, I wanted to wrap up. But also, for people that want to find out more, what's the best way for them to pop online and find out more?
Well, you can order the books on Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble or just about any bookseller. You can go in and ask for them. If they're not in the store, ask for them. They'll have them delivered. It's a traditionally published book. But it is on, a Kindle or paperback, whichever you like. But Amazon.com is probably the best way. Or you can find out more about me on my website, NancyColeSilverman.com. Or find me on Facebook, Nancy Cole Silverman. And I love to hear from people. I'd love to know what they think and are reading. And I thank you so much, Alex.
Of course. I want to remind everybody, so in case anyone's out there who has any doubt, it's Nancy Cole, C-O-L-E, Silverman. And she's the author of Shadow of Doubt, Beyond a Doubt, which just came out last year, and with the forthcoming Without a Doubt, which will arrive in May. So go on to Amazon or Google or hop on her website, find out more. There's a really cool photo of you on your website that has you you posed with a horse. Are you an equestrian?
I have been, and I have a great love of horses and animals altogether. I've had horses in my life. That was happy hour, by the way.
Are you telling us that you were drunk when you were riding that horse?
That was his name when I got him. I think somebody maybe I
oh,
have
oh,
I have
the,
visions
the
of how that
name
came
was Happy Hour.
It was Happy Hour. Happy Hour is a dressage horse of mine. I had to sell him a couple years back because he bounced me out of his life real big. He was about 17 and a half hands, and one day we had a little accident together. So I haven't been riding in a while, but I do have a big love of horses.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Pam. If you're listening, have a great night. Thanks for letting me sit in. I am Alex Dolan. You can reach me at alexdolan.com or look for Thrill Seekers on this network. All right, Nancy, have a good night.
Thank you so much.